chess pieces on the board, some ingenious trap we would all fall into, which would somehow result in everyone voting for her. What I did know, or at least strongly suspected, was that she knew what my contribution to the Neverworld was. I could tell by the way she looked at me, by her flat, implausible explanation, "I haven't been able to figure it out." Martha always figured everything out. For whatever reason, she'd decided not to disclose this piece of information. Not yet. Chapter 17. For the next couple of weeks, we stayed in the library at Wincroft, studying the dark house at Elsewhere Bend. We wanted to understand everything Martha had told us. We downloaded the audiobook and spent hours listening to all 1,322 pages, curled up under mohair blankets, drinking tea as the narrator, some young British actor from the Royal Shakespeare Company with an opera baritone and a schizophrenic ability to sound like completely different men and women, young, old, poor, aristocratic, told the futuristic tale of love and loss. It was a bewitching story, one of the best I'd ever heard, a heart-pounding mystery unfolding against a future world, fascinating and terrifying plot twists you couldn't see coming. The book took place far in the future. The main character, Jonathan Elster, was a bumbling, absent-minded professor at a university for outcasts in Old Earth. He taught a popular alternative philosophy course, Intro to Unknowns, which covered, among other things, the nuts and bolts of time travel. For years, Elster had been in love from afar with a mysterious woman named Anastasia Bent, who taught in the history department. When she accidentally stumbled upon a cover-up about the history of the universe and vanished, a fisherman witnessing her wandering a cliff walk suggested she committed suicide, though her body was never recovered. Jonathan set off on a perilous quest across space and time to find her. All of us grew silent and sullen as we listened. The violence at the Warwick police station had brought us all together, opened up the roped-off rooms in the sprawling, lavish mansion that had once been our friendship, flung the sheets off the furniture, turned on the lights. Now it seemed Martha's disclosure had us taking refuge in our separate rooms again, disappearing up winding staircases, holing up behind closed doors, the only hint of company an occasional creak of the floorboards overhead. I didn't know what they worried about. They chose not to confide in me, or, it seemed, in each other. My own anxiety had everything to do with Martha. Those bombshells she'd dropped, J.C. Gossamer Madwick, the physical laws of the Neverworld being tied to each of us, had prompted me to scrutinize her every knowing glance and comment even more closely than I had before. To my shock, I realized that somewhere in the time since I'd found her at Brown with Professor Bellarota, she'd managed to quietly seize control of the entire group. For years, her status had been peripheral. She was the tag-along sidekick, Jim's friend, the oddball you could count on to react to PETA commercials with some jarringly cynical comment like, "Such propaganda." Or when any couple ended up together at the end of a romantic comedy, "Another horror movie with a high body count." Martha had always made us roll our eyes and chuckle. Now, incredibly, impossibly, she was the one the others looked to for guidance, for expertise and reassurance. A few times I tried confiding in Kip, Whitley, and Cannon, hinting that I didn't trust Martha or this new direction she was urging us toward. They didn't share my suspicion.
"What do you mean she's up to something?"
Kipling asked me, frowning. "I don't know. It's just a feeling."
"But it's good old Martha, Rain Man. She's not conniving. She's too honest and goofy."
"I don't think so."
"Oh, come on."
"I'm serious. She knows more than she's letting on."
"Does it really matter?"
whispered Kipling.
"What else can we do, Bee? I don't know about you, but I need something to change. Anything.
Even if it means what?" He shrugged, his expression bleak, the meaning behind his unfinished sentence obvious. Even if it means we never get out of here. Our evenings passed in heated discussions about how to change the wake and get to the Masons. In the Bend, Jonathan Elster discovers time travel accidentally when following in the footsteps of the missing Professor Anastasia Bent, who the police believe committed suicide by jumping off a seaside cliff. As Jonathan follows suit, jumping from the exact spot where Professor Bent was last seen, plummeting 100 feet towards certain death, he finds himself crashing not into the rocky cliffs, but into the Thames in London in the year 2122. The open train compartment window for time travel always exists on the verge of death, said Martha. Which is why so few people ever find it. You have to think you're facing your death in order to reach it. So how do we find it here, in the Neverworld? I know I already asked you guys this, but have any of you ever tried to commit suicide? Again, we all shook our heads. Martha seemed perplexed by this response, though she only nibbled a thumbnail thoughtfully, saying nothing more. Another critical fact to remember was that for everyone to arrive at the right place and time, the same train compartment in the past or the future, we had to make sure it was the final thought in our heads right before the moment on the verge of death. We'll aim for Villa Anna Sophia on Amorgas Island one day in the past, Martha announced. Yesterday. August 29th. That's where we'll start. Why the past and not the future? Asked Cannon. You never know what tomorrow will bring. The future could hold a natural disaster, terrorist attack, alien invasion. The past has already happened, so we know what to expect. But if we're going into the past, I asked, why not just go straight to Vulcan Quarry on the night Jim died? Then we'll know everything. She's right, said Cannon. No, said Martha, shaking her head. No way. We're not ready. In the Bend, the train gets shorter and shorter with each leap in time. That means our wakes will get shorter. It'll cause too much instability. It could mean we won't have enough time to come to vote with a consensus. We have to start out slowly. I didn't buy her explanation. She seemed too quick to condemn my suggestion. But the others appeared to accept her answer. So I decided not to challenge her. Not yet. No one had been to Amorgas except me. Only I had visited Jim that summer. So the others could vividly envision the time and place, I showed them photos from the trip on my phone and told them what I remembered. The island's scalding brightness. The open-air jeeps the Mason family drove around the island, tearing down the dirt roads like an occupying army. Edgar Mason, shut away at all hours in his space-age office, from which he'd abruptly emerged like Zeus coming down from Olympus. If Zeus was tanned to the color of whiskey, had spiky hedgehog hair, and rose every day at 4 a.m. to practice Ashtanga yoga while whispering into an earpiece. Jim's younger siblings and their respective friends stampeding up and down the house's staircases like herds of antelope. Jim had two younger twin sisters, Gloriana and Florence, and two adopted brothers from Uganda, Cal and Niles. Much to my amazement, they had a Swahili tutor living with them. A cultural attaché, Jim said. Jim and I had spent most of our time alone, reading aloud from John Lennon biographies, diving off the dock, exploring the coastline in a blue skiff called Little Bird. We snorkeled and ate grilled fish doused with lemon that squirted into my eyes and stung. We fed dinner rolls to the packs of wild dogs that patrolled the night streets like gangs, and stayed up into the early morning at drunken family feasts at gangplank tables under a blue night sky, chains of yellow paper lanterns bobbing overhead. Though Jim had invited me to spend the entire summer with him, my parents only agreed to let me visit for 5 days. To get them to agree to even that took State Department levels of persuasion. Those 5 days passed in the blink of an eye, each tinged with a blinding, far-fetched sheen, which made me feel at once uncomfortable and bewitched. Jim's world was so vivid, so improbable. As suddenly as I was thrown into it, I was tossed out, marooned back in sleepy Watch Hill. Distracted and gloomy as I worked alongside my parents at the Crow, leaving milkshakes too long in the mixer, preparing egg salad sandwiches for customers who'd ordered turkey and Swiss. I was haunted, like Wendy, by memories of Neverland and Peter Pan. I spent the rest of the summer tabulating in my head the 7-hour time difference so I could picture what Jim was doing, and roared through the house like a caged lion tossed a fresh carcass to seize the phone in time whenever he called. Per Martha's instructions, I described as best I could a single room in the house. The main living room, with its dreamy gauze curtains, whitewashed furniture, and scalding view of the Aegean. This was so they could feel as if they'd been there too, could have it be the very last thought in their heads before the moment on the verge of death. Whatever that turned out to be. When the five of us weren't holed up in the library hashing over the bend, I'd grab an umbrella and head into the storm, hiking the property alone. As I walked, I could hear Martha's voice in my head, her unnerving whisper, "Your contribution is here. Somewhere." It was during one of these solitary walks when, heading down the narrow stairs to the dock, I noticed the trees writhing with an intensity that wasn't normal. The ocean was rough, whitecaps licking the inky water. The sailboats moored far out in the cove clattered and bobbed. Ropes had come loose from the masts, thrashing like snakes. A buoy clanged somewhere out on the ocean, the sound mournful, deathly. Suddenly I heard a woman's sharp scream. The moan of the wind made me think I'd imagined it. Then I heard another cry. This time it was a man. Two people were arguing. Sensing that the voices were coming from behind me, I closed my umbrella and hurried off the dock and out of sight, darting into the foot-wide space between the bank and wooden steps. Moments later, I heard them again. I realized they weren't coming from Wincroft at all, but from one of the sailboats out in the harbor. Dark figures were moving along the deck of one anchored close to the dock of the property next door. Andiamo, it was called. I remembered hearing Whitley mention it belonged to ESS Burt. A tiny gold light was shining from the bow. Then it came. Another scream. I waited. Minutes later, I heard a motor. A skiff was approaching. Peering through the steps, I saw Whitley. She was alone. She docked the boat, hastily knotting the ropes before climbing onto the pier, running up the steps. Her face caught the light as she barreled right past my head. She looked angry. I waited. When there were no further voices, I headed back to the house. I knocked once on the library doors, and opening them, I saw Whitley, soaking wet, sitting with Martha on the couch. They jolted upright as soon as I entered, startled looks on their faces. My first thought was of two teenagers surreptitiously smoking pot in a living room, suddenly interrupted by a parent. "What's the matter?" I asked. "Nothing," said Whitley. Martha smiled. "Could you give us a minute, Bee?" I stared at Whitley. Never had she preferred to confide in Martha over me. Never. Hadn't our friendship come back to life after all this time in the Neverworld? Weren't we friends again? But she only stared back at me, sullen. I left with a sinking feeling in the pit of my stomach, closing the door. Almost immediately I could hear Whitley, her voice low and muffled, her words indistinguishable. What the hell is going on? I headed upstairs. Searching the bedrooms, I found no sign of Cannon or Kipling either, which seemed to suggest they'd been aboard the boat too. Had they held some kind of secret meeting purposely behind my back? Why? What were they doing? I grabbed the umbrella, headed back outside, and hiked down to the dock. There was no obvious movement on the sailboat, and there were no more voices. I stayed there for another hour, watching. When nothing happened, I decided to hike back to Wincroft and as I hurried up the path, I noticed the keeper. Immediately, my throat constricted. The last time I'd seen him had been in the woods at Darrow. He seemed to have vanished for a time. Now he was back, a dark figure in a black raincoat, hunched over, drenched. He was digging with great exertion, his whole body contorting with each fling of dirt. I veered off the stone path to avoid him and sprinted through the trees. When I reached the house, I couldn't help turning back to look at him. He hadn't noticed me. He was still digging what I now realized were four muddy holes in the earth. Four graves. But that wasn't the strangest thing. He was wearing the black glasses of a blind man. I didn't have time to ruminate on what the keeper had been doing, or what it meant, because the very next wake the answer to the mystery of the sailboat argument and Whitley's private conversation with Martha came to light.
"Kipling has something to tell us,"
announced Martha as we all assembled in the library. "Whitley brought this to my attention late last wake, and I think it could help us."
"You didn't," Cannon said angrily to Whitley.
"I had to," she answered. He glared at her, livid.
"Oh, please, stop the policeman act. You want to get out of here, don't you? I mean, don't you want to find out what really happened to Jim?"
"It wasn't your secret to tell," he hissed.
"If it affects our ability to change the wake, it is."
"It's all right," said Martha, placing a hand on Cannon's shoulder. "You can tell us." That was when I noticed Kipling. He was crying, truly crying, in a way I'd never seen him before, the kind of crying that was more of a wringing out than normal tears. He was seated on the couch, head in his hands, tears streaming down his chin.
"I call it the black-footed Sioux carpet," he blurted suddenly, staring at the floor. "It's a form of self-harm. An unsuitable attempt to solve interpersonal difficulties. That's what the shrinks all call it. Mama Greer invented it. She coined the term from some crazy-looking rug she'd filched from an antique store. We did it together. Mother-son bonding. Sometimes we did it multiple times a week. She'd drive me out to a country road on a Friday night when she decided there was nothing good on TV. The first time I was 5. We'd lie down in the road side by side, holding hands, waiting for a car. Roll out of the way when I say bingo, she told me. We'll see how much God likes us. If he wants us to live. 'Cause I'll only say bingo if God tells me to, that's the deal.
Kipling shuddered.
I pissed myself, I was so scared. I hadn't said my prayers. Good God. I mean, did God even know I existed? Did he like me? He couldn't like me that much if he'd given me this face to go through life with. This body. I'd squeeze Mama Greer's hand. She was my lifeline. Then the car. You always felt it first in the pavement underneath you. It'd take Mama Greer a year to yell bingo, but it always came. I'd squeeze my eyes shut and roll out of the way. The tires would miss me by centimeters. By the time I opened my eyes, Mama Greer would be up dancing on the side of the road, whooping and hollering, yanking off all her clothes. See that? God loves us. He loves us after all. She was always in a good mood after that. If I was lucky, it lasted a whole week.
He fell silent a moment, rubbing his eyes. I could only stare. While I had known Mama Greer was dangerous, this was by far the most terrifying thing I'd ever heard she'd done.
It became an addiction, Kipling went on. The rush of it. I never stopped. Every few months, whenever things got out of hand or hopeless, I'd find a way to do my black-footed Sioux carpet. I'd sneak off campus. Immediately felt better. I did a big one junior year, right before Christmas break, when Rector Trask told me I couldn't return next semester. I was kicked out. I was the sort of student,
How did he put it? Who needed an environment with less vigorous expectations. Like he thought I'd do better in Sing Sing. My black-footed Sioux carpet after that nearly got me made into an egg scramble sandwich by a Folgers truck.
He glanced up, sniffing.
It certainly would have given new meaning to their slogan, the best part of waking up.
I gazed at him, speechless. Kipling had always been a rotten student. While I knew there had been cliffhangers at the end of every school year as to whether he was passing, I'd never known he was actually kicked out. His poor academic record had changed senior year when he managed to focus on his studies. By the time we graduated, he had done well.
It was Cannon who saved me, Kip said with a faint smile. He saw what I was trying so hard to hide.
You weren't that good at hiding it, said Cannon, grinning. You were walking with a limp and winced when you sat down.
Kipling looked at me.
Remember how I missed 2 months of school due to a family emergency?
I nodded. Vaguely, I remembered him telling me a vibrant and long-winded story about his aunt's heart condition.
It was all lies. I was at a treatment center in Providence doing Tai Chi, watercolor and fruit bowls, and developing a middle path to manage my unrestrained patterns of thought. It was Cannon who checked me in. Cannon, who came during visiting hours, coordinated with the shrinks on my progress. Lobbied Darrow to give me one last chance. He helped turn my grades around. Got my college applications ready. Sat up with me all night helping write my essay about Mama Greer. Mommy Bipolar, otherwise known as How to Survive in the Custody of a Complete Lunatic. That got me into Louisiana State. I'd be encrusted right now in the front tire treads of a UPS truck if it weren't for Cannon.
My mind was spinning. I thought back to senior year, and though I recalled Cannon as always quite busy, coming and going abruptly with his backpack and an armful of textbooks, never had I suspected what he was up to. But it made sense. He was the silent problem solver. The steady trickle of water that always finds a passage, Whitley used to say. Still, I felt hurt that they hadn't wanted to confide in me, that there had been an entire history happening right before my eyes about which I'd had no clue. "Why did you never say anything?" I asked Kipling. He glanced at Cannon, and I saw pass wordlessly between them some fleeting shadow of understanding that was gone almost as soon as I recognized it. Kipling shrugged.
There comes a point where your personal pile of crazy gets to be a bit much, even for your best friends.
That's not quite the whole truth, prompted Whitley expectantly, tilting her head. Kipling looked sheepish.
Yeah, well...
He cleared his throat.
My 11th-hour streak of C's and B's revealing me to be a decent student who'd only been pretending all that time to be abysmal? That wasn't real.
What are you talking about? I asked. He seemed unwilling to go on. Cannon hacked Darrow's network for him, blurted Whitley. All senior year. Kipling had every test from every teacher ahead of time, including midterms and finals.
Not every teacher, said Cannon.
She glared at him. It was still cheating. It was assisting a beloved friend, he said stonily. Whitley huffed. You could say the same thing about what I was doing as the White Rabbit. Everyone thinks I'm the bad person. Look at what you guys were doing. Cannon said nothing. For years he had assisted Darrow's notoriously backward IT department. It wasn't unusual for him to be summoned from class to help with some bug or networking error. And though he was glaring at Whitley now in obvious annoyance, he didn't appear to feel in the least bit guilty about this disclosure.
How did you do it?
I asked him.
Cannon shrugged. Social engineering. The weakest component in any given network is always the human. I sent a faculty-wide email, a required update for Darrow's intranet. For Kipling's teachers, I included a rat. They downloaded the Trojan and I became Root. It was as easy as untying a shoelace. He frowned at the look of disbelief on my face. Come on, Sister B. You of all people should understand. Darrow Harker was an obstacle in the way of Kipling's bright future. Kicked out junior year? He'd have to start over at some second-rate institution, away from us. It'd look like shit on his record. And anyway, Kipling can't be measured by such blunt objects as A's, B's, and C's. No. Kipling is an experience. I had to help him in the best way I could. He shrugged. There are the rules of this world, and there is what you do when life comes crashing down around you. Kenan stared at me with such a penetrating look, I felt chills inching down my arms. I'd forgotten how intense a presence he could be, how when he focused, he seemed more energy than flesh and bone.
So that's it, said Kipling. That's the two-headed monster in my closet who can't stop drooling.
The question is, Martha whispered, looking at him, will your secret help us change the wake? She fell silent, frowning, lost in thought. For a minute, no one said a word. That was what Martha did sometimes. Let a question dangle for minutes, sometimes even an hour, before suddenly blurting the answer when everyone else had forgotten the problem.
I have an idea, she said.
Chapter 18. That was how we came to be parked in the wild beach rows along the empty coastal road at 4:47 in the morning, 4 minutes before the end of the wake. Directly across the street was where we'd had the accident, where, according to the keeper, one Mr. Howard Hayward, age 58, of 281 Admiral Road, South Kingstown, had smashed his tow truck into our car, condemning us to the Neverworld, where somewhere, in some other dimension of time more real than this one, we were lying inside a totaled car inside a single second, waiting to unlock. Martha knew the exact spot. A hairpin curve twisting 160 degrees through dense pine trees. She admitted she'd come back here to inspect it in the Neverworld. How had it happened? I could hardly remember. Aggressive flashes of headlights blinding me, hedges of beech rose trembling in the torrential rain, windshield wipers waving as if in warning. Liquid night. Our drunken laughter spilling everywhere. Honking. Spinning. The car bouncing off the road, leaping into the dark. A loss of gravity. He's a drunk, Martha said. He sits in the Raccoon and Hound Saloon in Warwick and drinks 12 Coors Lights. 12! Then he climbs behind the wheel. He can hardly stay awake. Nearly crashes into a telephone pole. In the Neverworld, he drives straight past the spot where he hits us. But that marks the end of the 11.2 hours of our wake. Rain hammered the roof. The windshield and windows were fogged. I felt as if we were sealed inside a submarine at the bottom of the sea. The radio stuttered classical music. Only one car had passed us, a blue pickup. Spotting us nestled in the bushes on the side of the road, it braked and backed up. Martha unrolled the window.
You guys got a flat?
Asked a middle-aged man in a hunting vest.
Need a hand?
No thanks, said Martha. We're fine. We're looking for our lost dog.
He frowned, baffled by the sight of 5 teenagers dressed in green hooded ponchos smiling stiffly. With a perplexed grimace and nothing left to say, he drove off.
3 minutes, said Martha, checking her watch. I felt like I was going to be sick.
Kipling and Cannon's revelations, shocking as they were, had elicited more questions than answers. For one thing, everyone was acting strange, though it was difficult to put my finger on why. They were irritable and out of it. Twice, when they weren't aware I was watching, I saw Kipling and Cannon exchange long, knowing glances, the meaning of which seemed vaguely ominous.
What was going on? What were they planning?
And though Martha was coaching us, assuring us it was going to be fine, August 29th, 9:35 a.m., Villa Anna Sophia, Amorgos Island, Greece. That's all you have to remember, okay? The fact that she, of all people, was in charge of this operation only made it worse. What was she up to? Was she pushing us to follow in the footsteps of characters in The Bend so she could condemn us somehow, trap us in some train compartment of time? Or was it only about the vote for her? The vote. The vote. The vote. Now, hunched beside Whitley in the back seat, I could feel the wake coming over me, that familiar ocean wave immensity pressing down on my feet, inching into my shins. Abruptly, the radio belched with static, then began to cough and stutter, "Boys Don't Cry" by The Cure. The rain grew louder, as if the volume had been turned way up.
"I don't feel so swell," said Kip, pressing a hand to his throat.
Martha turned to him. "I feel it too. And it's not just the wake. It's the open window. It's happening." She was filled with excitement. As much as someone as deadpan as Martha could be filled with excitement. "Can you feel it?" I did. There was an electrical charge in my hands, as if I'd just shuffled across a heavy carpet in socks. I held my hand an inch from the steamed window. It made a print. I waved it back and forth, and it magically wiped the window clean. I held my hand a few inches behind Whitley's hair hanging outside the hood of her poncho, and the gold strands leapt right into my hand like the tentacles of some strange sea creature.
"2 minutes," said Martha. "Let's move."
She nodded at us and scrambled out, Cannon and Kipling taking off after her without a word. I opened the door and was instantly drenched by a blast of rain. Whitley grabbed my arm.
"I can't do this, Bee," she whimpered. "I can't keep it straight in my head."
"What?" She was crying. Never in my life had I seen her so afraid.
"I'm going to get lost in the past, I know it."
"No, you're not." I grabbed her by the shoulders. "Listen to me. August 29th, 9:35 a.m., Villa Anna Sophia. Say it."
"Villa Anna Sophia."
"Remember the sea, the sky, the pristine white beauty of it all, the curtains, the smell of oranges."
"Oranges, right."
"You've got this." She blinked at me, unsure. I held out my hand. She grabbed it. Then we both climbed out of the car into the downpour. I hadn't anticipated how chaotic it would be. The rain felt like nails. There was a gravitational pull intent on thrusting us back to the car. My thoughts turned to liquid, splattering the inside of my head. All we had to do was approach the spot of the accident and lie down in a black-footed Sioux carpet the way Kipling had explained it. So far, only Martha had made it. She was lying on her back along the faded yellow line. I headed toward her, trying to drag Whitley after me, but I was dizzy, and every step was like lifting 4 cinder blocks tied to my feet. Kip was standing in the road, turning in a circle like a cork caught in a toilet flush, and Cannon was on all fours trying to crawl. I forced my thoughts to slow. I took big steps, one at a time, squeezing Whitley's hand. Finally, we reached the spot and lay down beside Martha. A minute later, Cannon arrived with Kipling. I blinked, raindrops pounding my face. I couldn't see. The rain was falling too hard, so I closed my eyes. The wake had crept up to my knees, pushing me into the pavement. August 29th, 9:35 a.m. I could picture the rocky, windswept cliff, the modern white house poised there like an eagle's nest, nothing in the windows but a reflection of the sea.
50 seconds!
Bellowed Martha. Villa Anna Sophia.
"I can't do this!"
Whitley screamed. Someone scratched me in the face. I moved my arm to shield my eyes, realizing it was a giant oak branch torn off a tree. It had careened over us before cartwheeling down the road. Whitley was sobbing, trying to scramble to her feet. Cannon held her in place.
"Stop it," he shouted.
Let go of me! I can't do it!
Calm down!
Shouted Martha.
I can't! I keep thinking of other things! I can't stop my thoughts!
I heard the roar of the approaching engine. Howard Hayward, age 58, drunk and half asleep, was seconds away now. My entire body was shaking. I squeezed my eyes closed, my fingers gripping the pavement, trying to hold on. Amorgos Island, Greece. Someone else was screaming now. Kipling.
Stop it! Stop it! Don't you see? We're going to lose each other! It's a trick! It's a trap!
Thunder exploded like an atom bomb. My ears blew out, squeals and whines ricocheting strangely around my head. The wake was pressing down on my heart now, so strong it took a moment for me to realize something was viciously stabbing my neck. I cried out in pain, my cold, numbed fingers fumbling to see what it was. I felt something small, hard. I yanked it out of my neck, screaming. It was the bumblebee pin. The one Jim had given me. The one stolen from me. The rest happened at once. Headlights sliced through me. The truck was honking, careening toward us. Raindrops fell in slow motion. A howl of brakes. Someone was still screaming. I opened my eyes, catching a fleeting glimpse of a figure in a green poncho sprinting away, vanishing into the woods. Clanging metal. The truck was jackknifing, massive tires sliding on the wet pavement right toward my skull. A smell of scorched rubber. And hell. One. Two. Bumblebee pin. Jim. Part 3. Chapter 19. When I opened my eyes, it was daylight. I was face down in the grass. I lifted my head, heart pounding, feeling an overpowering wave of nausea. I was sick to my stomach, my body spasming. It took a minute to catch my breath. I wiped my mouth, looking around, my eyes stinging in the light. I was not on any coastal road. I was not being run over by Howard Hayward's tow truck, at least not anymore. I was in no physical pain. I also wasn't in the back of the Jaguar. For the first time in a century, it wasn't raining. The sun was shining. I was lying on the ground, dead leaves, dirt, surrounded by trees. It was brisk out, a bite in the air, the sky hard blue. I held out my hands, opening them. They were empty. The bumblebee pin, where is it? I looked around. I definitely wasn't near Villa Anna Sophia or on any Greek island. I was in the middle of a forest. I stared down at my clothing. The burgundy Ann Taylor wool coat my mother had picked up years ago at a secondhand store in Woonsocket. Black tights, black wool dress, scuffed black leather pumps. Puzzled, I stumbled to my feet. My shoes were too tight, my dress scratchy. I lurched forward, staring through the trees at a grassy clearing. There was a lake littered with small white sailboats, people milling around the perimeter. I stumbled toward it, wondering if I looked like some deranged lunatic. But as I stepped out of the woods and down the bank, no one gave me a second glance. There were at least 20 sailboats out on the lake, children and a few teenagers operating them by remote control. I understood where I was. Central Park. The Conservatory Lake. I'd visited here a long time ago with Jim.
There you are.
Hearing his voice was like having the floor drop out under my feet. I couldn't breathe. I closed my eyes, my mind jelly. I was falling through a hole a mile deep.
Where'd you go? Are you already trying to get rid of me?
He was alive. He was right behind me, his hand on my shoulder. He smelled the same. Peppermint soap, wind,
and fresh laundry.
I came out here all the time as a little kid. Once the remote control broke and my sailboat got stranded in the middle of the lake, and my father said as I cried, "If you want it, go get it." I had to wait out there and retrieve the thing. Clearly it was some survival of the fittest free market personality test he'd learned in business school and—
Hey, what's wrong?
He spun me around to face him.
What's wrong? How can I begin to answer that question? Look at me.
I opened my eyes. The sight of Jim Mason inches away from me, sun blazing behind him, birds chirping, kids squealing in delight, was so unfeasible my head turned inside out. This wasn't real. It couldn't be. But it was. It was Jim. He was the same, but he wasn't. As I stared up at him, it struck me how no one ever really sees anyone. Memory turns out to be a lazy employee, intent on doing the least amount of work. When a person is alive and around you all the time, it doesn't bother to record all the details. And when a person is dead, it Xeroxes a tattered recollection a million times so the details are lost. The freckles, the crooked smile, the creases around the eyes.
Come, Jim said. We can't be late.
He tucked my hand into the crook of his arm. I'd forgotten how we always did that. He escorted me down the path, past women wheeling babies in strollers, all of whom glanced at him with varying degrees of admiration, and a man pushing a shopping cart filled with plastic bottles. It seemed the wake had brought me to one of the occasions when I had visited Jim's family in New York. It wasn't Christmas, and it was too chilly for spring break. So when was it? I could ask him what we were going to be late to, but it was a daunting prospect to speak. Every time I looked at Jim, I felt jolts of disbelief. I wanted to annotate everything about him, every blink, sniff, and sideways grin. I was terrified, too. There was a lump in my throat like a giant wad of gum, threatening to dislodge. If it did, I'd end up crying or rambling on madly about the Neverworld, the fact that he was dead now. You're dead, my love. You have such little time. Biting my lip, I let him escort me across Fifth Avenue. We rushed into his building. 944 Fifth Avenue, read the elegant script on the green awning. Its lobby pungent with hydrangea and roses from the colossal flower arrangement on the table, asteroid-like and silencing. Jim casually waved at the doorman. Hola, Murdoch. Then we were alone in the elevator. Jim leaned back against the wood-paneled wall, surveying me. I had forgotten the way he studied people as if they were priceless pieces of art.
Don't be nervous, he said.
He was clutching my hand again, grazing his lips against my knuckles as he pulled me, walking backward, into his apartment. I had forgotten how grand it was, echoing like a museum. Iron sculptures of birds and oil paintings of stark faces, spindly furniture more giant praying mantises than viable places to sit. Looking down, I noticed the scuffs on my Mary Jane pumps, the lint balls on my old stockings, and felt that familiar cringe of embarrassment. As we moved into the living room, slipping through the crowd, I noticed everyone was wearing black. Black dresses, black and white and red silk scarves, blue suits, and I understood where I was. Freshman year at Darrow, 5 years ago, a weekend in late September. Jim had invited me to come home with him for his great-uncle Carl's funeral. I barely knew Jim back then. He'd only introduced himself a week before. Jim Mason. He was sitting behind me in English. He pulled his chair over, so close I could feel his peppermint breath on my cheek as I tried to work out a rhyme for a song I was writing.
What you doing?
He frowned at the notebook I was scribbling in.
What's Fen Fang's Chinese Laundry Meltdown, an original soundtrack? Embarrassed, I slid the book under my laptop.
Nothing.
That didn't look like nothing. I cleared my throat. It sounded like a swamp.
I create fake album soundtracks for movies that don't exist. It's just something I do. Don't ask me why.
I see.
He nodded matter-of-factly.
So, when's the commitment to the mental institution happening? Next week? Next year? I laughed.
He extended his hand.
Jim Mason, really delighted to make your acquaintance before they cart you off to your padded cell.
Beatrice Hartley.
He winked. I'm a mad poet, too.
I smiled. There was a stretch of awkward silence, during which Jim did nothing but sit back and survey me. I turned to my laptop, trying to stop blushing, pretending to type something important. I assumed he was about to return to his desk and leave me alone. Instead, he started to beatbox, not even trying to be cool about it.
There was a fetching girl in my English class, wary as a bluebird, radiating class. I'm scared to look away from her in case she flies away. Congress needs to declare her a national holiday.
Everyone in class went silent, a boy behind me snickering. Little did I know that this was how it would always be, that being the subject of Jim's attention would be like having a bomb go off in my face. Unexpected, shocking, accompanied by a fallout of popular girls suddenly approaching me with long, swingy mermaid hair and doubtful glances.
How do you know Jim Mason? You're from New York? Did you go to Spence?
I'm from Watch Hill. No, I went to Watch Hill East. I don't know Jim. That was how I met Whitley. She was friends with Jim from some exclusive Native American camp in the Blue Ridge Mountains. Jim Mason has a crush on you. It was the first thing she ever said to me. I hurried along the hallway, clutching the strap of my backpack like it was my flotation device and I was drowning.
No, he doesn't.
Yes, he does. She peered at me, frowning.
He calls you haunting. He said you're old-fashioned and innocent. Like you're from the 1940s or something and have been transported here by time machine.
Thanks.
It's a compliment.
The next day, suddenly Jim was strolling beside me down to the athletic fields. My heart flopped like a freshly caught fish.
Did you grow up on an Amish farm milking cows at sunrise? He asked.
No.
You look like you did.
Okay.
Want to come home with me this Sunday?
He asked it like he was offering me a bite of his sandwich.
I said no. Sunday was Family Sunday, which meant Darrow's students either went home for the day or signed up for a field trip to a museum. I hadn't seen my mom and dad in a month, and they'd planned an elaborate lasagna dinner. Of course, the truth was I said no because I was terrified by Jim's attention, the brash, drenching spotlight of it, both blinding me and causing everyone else to stare. Little did I know, no to Jim was simply a yes that hadn't happened yet.
Beatrice!
He shamelessly rapped at the start of English, causing our teacher, Mrs. Henderson, to regard me with irritation.
She's a realist with secrets. A conscienceless realist who leaves me sleepless and speechless. Oh, Beatrice!
He left notes in my locker. Say yes, jump off a cliff with me. He recorded a theme song about me. It got passed around the entire school.
The Queen's Neck, please. I heard a girl hiss during chapel.
Say yes,
Jim blurted when he passed me in the hall.
Yes to what? Having his babies? The varsity volleyball captain snarked to her friends.
Jim called my parents to formally introduce himself, discuss train times to and from Penn Station, give them his word that I'd be safe with him, that he was a gentleman. This deluge of attention would have been too much, coming from anyone who wasn't Jim Livingston Mason, Jim of the thick, tangled black hair, the chocolate eyes, the sideways grin.
He sounds so adorable and kind of quirky, actually, said my mom. Back then, she'd been naive about the old money jungle of Darrow and Jim's lion-like position inside it.
It's wonderful you're already making some interesting connections, said my dad.
The Sunday trip to Jim's house for the funeral, this very trip, would end in disaster. Fast forward 5-6 hours, I'd be taking a train home from New York early, alone, the reasons for which Jim and I always argued about afterward. To this day, I found it difficult to recall what had really happened. What had I been so upset about? I could never separate my shyness, my self-consciousness at being painfully underdressed and awkward from the truth. During the post-funeral buffet, held in some relative's Gilded Age apartment on Park Avenue, I remembered Jim disappeared for what felt like a torturous period of time. I'd grabbed my coat off the hall rack and snuck out without a word to anyone. I cried the whole ride back to school. I vowed, unreasonably, because even then my feelings for him felt as inevitable as a seawater in a rowboat full of holes, that this would be the end of my friendship with Jim Mason. That Monday morning, however, during English, he placed a red Cartier box on the notebook I'd been drawing in. "Forgive me." Inside the box was a diamond-encrusted bumblebee pin. The bumblebee pin. Thinking of how it had mysteriously gone missing from the sock drawer in my dorm room, then abruptly reappeared all these years later, jammed in the side of my neck as we lay in the middle of the coastal road, sent a fresh wave of shock through me. Clearly it had been meant as a means of sabotage, a surefire way to get rid of me, make me think of Jim, thereby pulling me into some compartment of the past. Whoever had done it had meant to hurt me, purposefully destroy any chance we had of voting and leaving the Neverworld. Which one of them had done it?
Cookie?
I jumped, startled. I realized dazedly I was in the Masons' living room staring out the window at Central Park, which from this height looked like an architectural rendering of a park with pipe cleaner trees. One of Jim's adopted siblings, Niles, 9 or 10 years old, was offering me a stack of cookies held between his thumb and forefinger. I took one.
Thanks.
He squinted.
You're Jim's latest girlfriend?
No, I'm a friend of his from school.
Well, take care you don't go.
The little kid crossed his eyes, making a deranged clown face.
Like all the others.
I laughed.
Whoa, did you see that?
The kid moved to inspect a large red Rothko, which had just fallen clean off the wall, revealing a dark square of what appeared to be mold.
That was totally poltergeist!
I smiled stiffly, moving away as Jim led his mother over. Mom, this is the girl I was telling you about, Beatrice Hartley.
Hello there.
Mrs. Mason was beautiful, her black suit sealing her like an envelope. She extended her hand like it was a gift. I'd forgotten how chilly she could be, the boredom in her smile, the flick of her eyes over my shoulder, as if somewhere behind me something more charming was always happening, like dolphins leaping out of the sea.
Darling, did you speak to Artie Grossman about the Curran?
Mr. Mason stepped over. He was short and tan, with spiky hair and the tense stare of all moguls. His teeth were big and artificially white, hinting they'd glow in the dark during a blackout.
Dad, said Jim. This is Beatrice.
Mr. Mason smiled warmly, shaking my hand.
Just started Darrow Harker with Jimmy, is that it? How are you finding those old-school traditions and Kennedy smiles?
Fine.
Wonderful, wonderful. Glory, did you talk to Artie?
I'll do it right now, said Mrs. Mason. She was smiling again, drifting away.
Lovely to meet you,
she said unconvincingly over her shoulder. I couldn't help staring after the two of them, wondering how they had reacted to Jim's death. What had they done, all these polished, perfumed people? Had any of them screamed and lost their minds as I had? Or had life simply floated on?
Jim was dead now.
He was lying in a coffin underneath a gravestone that read, "Life, Now, Forever," in Sleepy Hollow Cemetery. In this sunlit apartment with the thick walls and marble floors, the idea was unfathomable. Jim smiled after them. He appeared to mistake my stare for admiration. "They met on the R train when they were 20 years old, still madly in love after 28 years. Completely unforgivable. Come." He clasped my hand again. We slipped through the crowd, past mute housekeepers in gray uniforms, a waiter holding a tray of triangular sandwiches like little starched pocket squares. He whisked me out of the living room, past three siblings playing wiffle ball in the foyer.
"Totally inappropriate," Jim shouted at them.
A wood-paneled library with a ladder to retrieve the thousands of first-edition leather-bound books. A dining room with a modern steel chandelier that looked like a giant tarantula. In 2 years, I'd eat Christmas dinner there, and his mother wouldn't say a word to me the entire meal. His father would call me Barbara. Jim pulled me through a door and closed it behind me. It was his bedroom, a shadowed, chaotic rock star's lair with electric guitars mounted on the wall and sheet music covering every flat surface, handwritten quarter notes and half-rests spangling the bars. Synthesizers, a Macintosh stereo, three laptops, piles of notebooks burping up pages where song lyrics were taking shape in terrible handwriting. Lost Little Blue, a biography of Janis Joplin, Sweeney Todd, the complete score, a framed copy of a Bruce Springsteen Madison Square Garden set list signed with a note, "Love you, Jimmy. Keep hearing the music. Bruce." Rumpled boxers and t-shirts and rolled-up posters swamped the corners of the room. Jim was rifling through a bookshelf looking for something. "Okay, so I have this song I wrote about a girl I haven't met yet," he said, pulling out a notebook. "Immortal She. It's about the love you have for someone that can't die, no matter how far apart you are, even if you're separated by death or time. That's what I'm searching for." The lump in my throat was there again, a pile of rubble. He began to read the lyrics, as he would countless times after this. I came to know that song well. It was one of the best he ever wrote. I'd sing it for him on a picnic blanket at school during finals week. He'd sing it to me some nights at Wincroft as I fell asleep. I remembered this exact moment. I'd related it to Whitley a dozen times, because it was the classic chorus refrain of "The Ballad of Jim and Bee," an old standard. This was the first time we were ever alone together, our first deep conversation. Our first kiss was seconds away. Having it before me again made me feel paralyzed, out of control. As he read, stumbling over a word here and there, pausing to scratch his nose, he seemed so beautiful and so young. Younger than I ever remembered. He raised his chin and strained his voice a funny way on certain words, as if they were spears he was launching blindly over a wall. "It's beautiful," I said when he finished. He had a funny look on his face. He carefully set the book on his desk and sat beside me. "I was going to wait to do this, like, weeks, and be this total gentleman and woo you like a knight in medieval times. But I'm punting that plan. I'm not a knight. I'm not even a gentleman. But I am devoted. Once I decide I'm with you, it never goes away. I swear to you that, Beatrice." He kissed me. There was a whole world in that kiss. Every moment of pain, regret, loneliness I'd felt since he'd died fell away. I'd missed him so much. How much hit me only now. As his hands slid down my back, I knew I was going to tell him about the Neverworld, the Keeper, the Vote, his death. Would he be able to tell me why he died if I asked him? Couldn't we run out of here, get into a car, and go live out the wake at a highway motel where the light was gold and the carpet full of vending machine crackers? Tomorrow we could do it again. And again. And again. I didn't have to be without him anymore.
I'd tell him everything. He, of all people, would understand. It'd be like it was before.